Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Hello and welcome once again to this week's edition of the C.S. Lewis Podcast. It's Justin Brierley, Premier's Theology and Apologetics Editor, sitting in once again for Ruth Jackson as we bring you some bonus material. And last week we heard the beginning of my interview with Max McLean, Founder and Director of the Fellowship of Performing Arts and the person behind the new C.S. Lewis movie, The Most Reluctant Convert. You'll be continuing to hear our conversation in just a moment's time. Before we get to that, you may be aware that the C.S. Lewis podcast is part of a range of podcast shows and resources from Premier Unbelievable. And we've got a special event coming up. Unbelievable.live is the place to go for a special Q&A, live Q&A with Oxford professor and thinker John Lennox. That's coming up very shortly on Tuesday the 7th of December from the time we release this podcast. So if you would want to be part of that live, then make sure you're booked in at unbelievable.live. Doing it in partnership with the film's producers, Caris Productions and Pensmore Films. They've produced a new video documentary of John's life called Against the Tide. But last chance to get booked in for this special live Q&A. Be part of it at unbelievable.live. Well, the second part of our interview with Max McLean now. Max is the performer and director behind the new C.S. Lewis movie, The Most Reluctant Convert. And if you want to find out more about it, how to possibly view it, when it'll be on general release, that kind of thing, check it out at cslewismovie.com. And for all things C.S. Lewis, you can also visit our show page at cslewispodcast.com.
I never cared for my name, Clive Staples. The world came to know me as C.S. Lewis. Perhaps you've read my books. The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe is the most famous, but there's one story that's not so well known. It's my story. And who better to tell it than me?
Max, tell us about the two other actors, key actors, because obviously this traces the journey through Lewis's life. You're there as sort of introducing, and then it's a beautiful way in which you weave yourself into the scenes with the other Lewises. It's very, very well done. But tell us about these other actors who I think that the younger of which has gone on to become quite a name recently, haven't they?
Yes. So the structure of the film is we begin to live in Lewis's memories. Lewis is probably his age would be around 52, right around 1950. The reason we select 1950 is because it's pre-Narnia and it's pre-Joy Davidman. Both of those things are yet to come. But Lewis had already begun writing his autobiography, and he looks back on the time between 1908, when his mother died of cancer when he was nine, to 1931, when he took communion for the first time since he was a child at Holy Trinity Church in Headington, just outside Oxford, Christmas in 1931. He was 32 years old. So that's the period. And so when he looks back, We cast two actors, introducing a marvelous boy actor to play the boy Lewis, named Eddie Ray Martin, who's just so charming and kind of a bit of an urchin. He looks to me like what Lewis would look like at 9 years old. And of course, you know, the struggles with his father come through, and the devastation of the loss of his mother comes through. Then by the time the story gets to about 16 years old, the actor changes to a young Lewis, the Lewis that goes off to war, the Lewis that becomes the young scholar at Oxford. And that's played by Nicholas Ralph, who's making a name for himself in Britain and in America as James Herriot in All Creatures Great and Small. And he's just marvelous as the young Lewis. And so the play, the film goes back and forth into, and of course we cast the mother, the father. We have the great Nock, we have Tolkien, Dyson, and Barfield are all part of the movie.
Yeah, that's the lovely thing. Lots of these characters who were so influential on Lewis are brought to life as well in the course of the film. You mentioned there his first communion, and I'd forgotten this from having obviously read it at some point in his memoirs and so on, but he regarded this as a terrible thing that he did to have gone through confirmation and communion without actually having believed any of it. I mean, just describe what Lewis says about this and why he felt so guilty afterwards about this.
Well, he said it was the worst act of his life. The worst act of his life was he said
we'll get a taster here.
I allowed myself to prepare for confirmation, be confirmed, and make my first communion all in total disbelief, acting a part, eating and drinking my own condemnation, he says. I knew I was acting a lie. I simply could not tell my father my real views. Not that he would have stormed. Let's talk the whole thing over, he would have said. But the thread would have been lost at once. Here again, he's talking about his relationship with his father. His arguments, I would not have valued a straw. The beauty of the authorized version, the Christian tradition. Oh, it was all sentiment. Nor could I, it was all sentiment. And if I tried to make my exact points clear, there would have been thunder from him and a thin, peevish rattle from me, nor could the whole subject ever have been dropped.
It's a great moment in the film. I really enjoyed that. What did you learn in the process of both creating the stage play and obviously doing the film about Lewis that perhaps you hadn't quite realized in before, having obviously been a fan of Lewis for some time up to that point?
Well, the thing I think everybody discovers with Lewis is you never get to the bottom of him. You know, that's why people keep coming back to him. It's a bottomless pit, mostly because his intellect and his emotion are so tied together. That's why it makes it really work theatrically. It all combines. So it's not like he's just a head, you know, where so many academics are, or he's just this, you know, just all emotion where, you know, he brings it all together. And I think, and he's so transparent. You know, I've always been kind of struggling because he was a very private person that just shouted from the rooftops his most private thoughts. You know,
it's a strange kind of contradiction in terms, isn't it? But I know exactly what you mean. He wasn't an extrovert exactly, but he was incredibly transparent when it came to his actual writing and very honest, you know, about his shortcomings and everything else. Let's talk about the conversion itself, because obviously that's at the center of this film. Mm-hmm. And what many people don't realize is that this was a multi-stage journey that Lewis went on. Do you want to just describe what those stages were and how you bring them out in the film?
Yeah, it's a little tough. Lewis when he describes it in Pilgrim's Regress, or he said it was, you know, he thought that his conversion was from atheism to idealism to pantheism to theism. He says he thought that that it was a conversion a lot of people went through. He says nobody goes through it like that. He says it was like he compared it to somebody's travels through the Gobi Desert as being as obvious to the general public as the rail from Oxford to London. You know, and so he starts with atheism and then idealism, and that sort of happens with Barfield. You know, it's like, are your moral and aesthetic is your moral aesthetics valid, meaningful? He says they are. Is logic? Does logic and deduction lead to indisputable truth? He says it does. Mm. So Barfield says then, well, your materialism has to be abandoned. Because otherwise it's all, your materialism says that you have to trust your mind, and you can't. Mm. It's all biochemistry and physics and that just, Lewis was shocked by that, because his reasoning was it's all natural selection, random mutation, allowing humans to have a reproductive advantage over other species.
You kind of represent this in the film as this conversation that happens in Lewis's rooms between himself and Barfield. But what it was, you know, I recently reread Miracles by Lewis, and it was all, you know, chiming with that, obviously. So, but are you saying that really it was Barfield who first kind of put those ideas in his head, you know, that he was the originator of
at least challenged him? I think they were already there, but they challenged him because, you know, he didn't want to have anything to do with the supernatural. He had something called the new look, which was to just be, you know, just the straight and narrow. Don't do anything that's out there in the theological world, the supernatural world. Because he also had a taste for the occult, which was something that I didn't know. So he's dabbling, and I guess Barfield allowed him to ground it into reality. I think he makes a very famous statement in Surprise by Joy, that, he said, that my first step was to abandon the absurd notion that the universe is an arbitrary alternative to nothingness. That was the first step. And that led him to an idealism that God is out there. If Hamlet and Shakespeare could ever meet, it would have to be Shakespeare's doing. In Lewis's original experience, Shakespeare's way out there and Hamlet's down here. They never meet. And he says, but what if Shakespeare wrote himself into the play? And that's where it became more theistic for him, theistic in the sense of the God of the Bible, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. At one sense, he says, my God was like the God of the Jews. And he couldn't come to terms with Jesus until much, much later, and particularly through that walk
let's get this in place then, because obviously the title of the film and the stage play comes from a very well-known passage in Lewis's, I think it is A Surprise by Joy, where he talks about one particular night in his rooms in Oxford when he's in turmoil and he feels like God has been chasing him down, until finally he relents and kneels and prays, at that point the most dejected and reluctant convert in the whole of England. Now, what is he actually at that point converting to? Because it becomes apparent, I think, in the film that he starts to go to church at that point. He starts to sort of take on, if you like, wants to do something to
fly his flag, he says.
Yeah, fly his flag. But it doesn't feel like he's kind of embraced at that point full-bodied Christianity. Is that fair to say?
No, but what's very interesting is he embraces full-bodied theism. You know, that God is real, that God is God, you know, that that he owes his allegiance to the God who made the universe. He just can't. And so to you and I, who grew up in the Christian tradition, we immediately apply a Christian interpretation of that. But he said that I knew nothing of the incarnation. The God to whom I serve was not human. That's, you know, but it was, but he did not think the universe was arbitrary. He thought the universe was purposeful, and he owed his allegiance to his creator. So in a certain sense, he gives tremendous support to theism. And I think we sort of discount that a little too much.
Yes. It's just so interesting, though, because there's these various moments. You know, there's one thing where he's on a bus and he says, by the time I walked off the bus, you know, I'd decided in my mind that, that God existed. And then you've got this sort of more kind of
personal... That's the motorcycle ride.
Yeah, that's it, the motorcycle ride. There is this famous walk again on in the grounds of Magdalen College, isn't it? With a very another very very well known writer, J.R.R. Tolkien. So describe what this is, where you find this in Lewis's own memoirs, and how it's represented in the film. But what the big point of this particular conversation was?
Well, first of all, we have to kind of set up the fact that this is J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, you know, two people on Mount Olympus, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, just regular everyday colleagues at Oxford in 1931, you know, hadn't written anything of any import at that time. Who knew what they were going to be? They're having a conversation that pretty much revolutionized a spiritual map of the world from that point on. The key issue was that Lewis was said, sort of admitted to Tolkien that I have, with great reluctance, come to believe in God, but not Christianity, he said. And that's a, you know, that's a key point, because he couldn't understand how the life and death of someone else, whoever he was 2,000 years ago, could help him or anyone else here and now. He just didn't get it. Didn't understand the Christian revelation at all. And Tolkien takes a completely different path that really is quite extraordinary. He uses Lewis's, you know, they shared a common interest in mythology. He says, and so Tolkien asks him, when you meet a god that sacrifices himself in a pagan story, and they're all over the place in pagan history, Balder, Dionysus, Osiris, all over the place. Tolkien reminds him, you like it very much and are mysteriously moved by it, provided you meet it anywhere except the Gospels. And then he makes the point out, the story of Christ is a myth, working on us in the same way as other myths, with one tremendous difference. It really happened. It's the myth in which all the other myths point. It's the true myth behind all the myths. And for some reason, you know, I mentioned earlier about when that person said, you know, Jesus was person just like Lincoln, just like George Washington. That was a kind of moment for Lewis, because it made him read the Bible differently, read the Gospels differently. Because in the past, he was probably reading it as a textbook, you know, looking for prescription. You know, but here he was reading the story of a hero, the archetypal hero, where he saw the, you know, as Jordan Peterson would say, the worst possible thing happened to the best possible person. And it changed it, because now he had to come to terms with Jesus. And in all this, you know, all of his apologetics about Jesus then come to light after that moment.
It's a really interesting one, because obviously up to that point, it had been a very intellectual journey, arguably. At this point, it feels like his imagination steps into that worldview, and suddenly a penny drops, and it's as though, yes, this is what I was waiting for. This is why I, because we all know that Lewis, you know, was a huge fan, got so much joy out of the mythologies and everything that he was, you know, a scholar of. And I think it was this point that he realized it's real. That it's not just I'm enjoying fantasy, it's that the fantasy becomes real in Jesus. There's this sort of touch point with reality where I don't have to be an atheist materialist over here while simply enjoying this other world that somehow bears no relation to it. No, these two worlds have come together. And that's that. I think you do that so well in the book. I feel a bit like, you know, Tolkien had his own movie out not so long ago, and that really underplayed, frankly, his Catholic faith. I feel like we need a Norman Stone version of the Tolkien story of
that,
as well.
Yeah, that could happen.
Who knows? Look, why does Lewis remain so phenomenally influential and indeed popular, especially in the USA? I mean, he's obviously still a great name here in the UK, but if you know, it's often out of the US actually that I'm hearing the most. You know, over 50 years on from his death, people are still wanting to write film, talk about Lewis. What's the enduring appeal there, Max?
You know, I've been thinking about this more recently. In many ways, listening to some of your programs, because I think Lewis is a bridge from the postmodern world that we're all steeped in, you know, that we're educated in, which basically says here we have to live for the here and now, and there's very little concern about this other world. And Lewis is always talking about this other world. And he makes that other world so compelling. Part of it is, you know, he didn't have a formal theological education, so he comes to theology from a literary perspective. He read everything from the Greeks to the moderns. He had a steel trap mind that could recall everything he said. He had this extraordinary ability to translate that into magnificent prose and speech. You know, I think arguably he's one of the greatest writers who ever lived. You know, I mean, certainly in terms of the kind of writing, the kind of reading that I've done. You know, and I've read all of Shakespeare. I've read a lot of Dostoevsky. I've read less and less of moderns because they just don't do anything for me anymore. But I just find that he allows me to go places supernaturally, imaginatively, theologically, that I don't get to any other way.
And I think that's, you know, I as you know, I work in the world of apologetics, and we try and find creative ways of bringing it across. But Lewis was had that supreme ability to use the imagination and creativity through the written word to do that, whether it was Screwtape or Narnia or the Space Trilogy or whatever it was. He seemed to understand what actually was the winning combination, if you will, of bringing the intellect and the imagination together. I think that's what you've done with this film as well, if I dare to say that. I think it's a wonderful way in which you're in that tradition. But sadly, apologetics as a whole tends to remain very one-sided. It's almost entirely an intellectual pursuit, and too often it's divorced from the arts, from the imagination. I mean, do you feel like that's going to change? Do you feel like we're heading in the right direction? Because I feel like we need another C.S. Lewis, or we all need to become a little bit more like C.S. Lewis.
Well, I do think that's true, but there was a quote, I think it was Austin Farrar, and I'm going to paraphrase it from memory, but he essentially says, see if I can find it, that yeah, in fact, it's if you can bear with me, it's probably worth finding, because it comes at a I'm writing a new play called Further Up, Further In. It's going to be developed next year, and he tells a wonderful story about he says, I do suffer from an incurable intellectualism. I love that. He says, of course, the direct evangelical appeal, come to Jesus, is still remarkably effective. Mm. He says, I've seen it done. I love that. I've seen it done. He says, I can't do it, but those who can ought to do with all their might. And he tells a story about a vicar who once asked him to make such an appeal at an RAF meeting during the war, and he said to him, I wish I could do the heart stuff. You do the heart stuff. I'll do the head stuff. But in this, I was quoting Austin Ferrer. He says, it's not that rational arguments create belief. He says, I don't believe that. He says, on the other hand, I do think the lack of it destroys conviction. And this is the key point. What is proved may not be embraced, but what no one defends is soon abandoned. Hmm. I was really struck by that because, you know, we do get a little bit discouraged, you know, by the apologetic enterprise. But we can't stop it. Because I think this last point, and this is something Lewis believed, but what no one defends is soon abandoned. And that's what's happened at the American University. It's not that they think Christianity is nefarious. They think it's irrelevant. And so nobody defends it. The case is not made.
Yeah.
Right? It's assumed. So it's really important.
Yeah. Fantastic. Well, I guess it's been such fun talking to you, Max, and getting to spend some time just reliving, yeah, Lewis and the process that has come to be with this film. Now, you've got some screenings throughout November, haven't you, in
yes.
the USA. What's the best way? CSLewisMovie.com?
Yeah, CSLewisMovie.com. I mean, right now it's only in America, although we just opened up 43 screens in Canada. This is way beyond me. You know, we work with all the movie chains, and I'm really happy to say tickets are really moving fast, which does mean that if it's moving fast, then the movie chains and those people that be, the powers that be, will open it up to worldwide release after our American release. So I do think that, and particularly because the subject matter is so evergreen, that I do think it's going to have a long life.
Yeah. Well, whenever you're listening to this show, just check at cslewismovie.com and you'll find out what the best ways for where you are to be able to access the film. I mean, does this mean the Fellowship of Performing Arts is moving generally in the direction of movie and video, Max?
I think so. In fact, Norman and I are reading many, many scripts to look at what's the next film that we want to do. I mean, we're always going to be a theater company. In fact, we have The Great Divorce on stage right now. I mentioned briefly that I'm working on a new script that's a follow-up, because after Lewis's conversion, it wasn't really obvious that he would become the person he became. So
sure.
What were the steps that led to that? And so the next piece is called Further Up, Further In, which I'm very, very excited about.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, what I was left with at the end of the film was thinking, but we've only just got to the point just before he really takes off now, you know, that there's a whole other story. And obviously others have told parts of that story in Shadowlands and other things. But
right.
But I wait with bated breath to see what you may have in store, Max. Max McLean, thank you so much for being with me. It's been such fun catching up, and all the very best as you continue to promote the film. I hope many, many people see it and benefit from it.
Thank you so much, Justin.
It's been great to have you on. Again, if you want to find out more about the film, do just go to the website, cslewismovie.com. I'll make sure there's a link from today's show so that you can find out more about it. And I highly recommend it. I spent the evening the other night with Lucy watching it, and we both really, really enjoyed it. So go and check it out if you can. I hope you enjoyed part two of my conversation with Max McLean today on C.S. Lewis, The Most Reluctant Convert, the new film that he has written and starred in. And don't forget, if you like C.S. Lewis, Thinking Christianity, that kind of thing, you might want to get along to our special Unbelievable Live event with John Lennox. It's coming up very shortly, Tuesday, the 7th of December. You can be there with us live via Zoom at unbelievable.live. Simply register for free, and you'll be able to join us on the night. For now, have a good week and see you next time.